This is History Untold. I'm Jessie Mazzoni. Each episode, our guests from around the world will share parts of history that are often unknown or misunderstood. There's no single perspective or story that encompasses the whole truth. So if you hear something that doesn't sound right, or you disagree with anything that a guest or I says, please let us know. Email us at historyuntoldpodcast@gmail.com.
So today we're talking to Adolfo Camargo.
Well, hi everyone. Thank you, Jessie, for inviting me. This has been it's a pleasure, and I'm honored that that you chose me as one of your interviewees.
I'm honored that you wanted to be my first one. So thank you for doing it.
So I'm from Brazil. I'm a former Fulbright scholar. I taught Portuguese in the United States for a year, for two semesters, and I'm originally from the state of São Paulo in Brazil. And I currently work as a teacher, as an English teacher, and I have worked as an English professor at a university here, and I'm also a translator. So I basically, right now, my main source of income is teaching. So I'm an educator, and I've been an educator. I've been a teacher since college, but I also work as a translator.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. And just so the listeners know, Adolfo and I have been friends for like 5 years now, 6 years now.
6 years now.
Yeah, since you studied, since you were a Fulbright teacher in the United States at our school in Meadville, Pennsylvania. So that's how we met back 6 years ago.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
It is crazy, yeah. And I thought you were old because you were 22. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, for those who might be interested, I'm 28 now, so.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just gave your age away.
I'm turning 29 this year, so.
Awesome. No, thanks for being on. And so the goal of the podcast today is to talk about an event or moment in history in Brazil that most people probably aren't aware of if they're not from Brazil, and maybe if they even are from Brazil. But before we get into that, I'm really excited to talk about that. But before we get into it, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about why, in your perspective, why you think it's important to have international exchanges and intercultural exchanges. Maybe you can talk about your experience, if it was studying abroad in the United States, if it was going back to Brazil. I know that that's something, I personally know you and know that that's something you're passionate about, but maybe can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I think there are several layers of how having international experience can help you and can change you. So from my perspective, I feel like one of the most important things that it changed about me was how I became even more professional when it comes to like having professional exchanges. And I feel like when you go abroad, especially I went to the United States, which in my experience, you guys were very like, Americans are very serious about how they work and being punctual. So those were some things that I learned and that I still benefit from even now, 6 years later. And I also think that even if you don't look for that kind of information, you start learning in real life as soon as you set foot in a different country, you start learning about race and class,
right,
and culture. And it's not even like, even if you even if you think, oh, I don't want to learn about that, but I think it's just something that you can't help but just internally absorb all of that. Right. And I think that's really interesting. I had never thought about race before I went to the United States. And it was, first it was shocking, but then it was eye-opening.
Shocking and eye-opening aren't mm-hmm. too far apart. But like, what would you say you learned from that once you got past the shock part? Because the shock obviously must have been challenging. But like, was there something to learn there? Or was it mostly just a different experience?
Oh, definitely. I'm not sure if it's because of the environment I was in, but I feel like living abroad made me understand more the world and the system that we live in. You know what I mean? It made me realize what is my role in this, in the capitalist system, in how education can actually change people's lives. And in general, I think it just made me more mature. It made me grow up way faster than I would have if I hadn't been to the US.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think even if it's not necessarily an international experience, I think anytime you go somewhere that's very different, even within your own country, right?
Yeah.
You can be forced into that growing experience, which is hard and scary.
And even like very, very simple things. So before I lived in the US, I had never like traveled really far from home in Brazil. But when I got to the US, I met all of these Brazilians from all different places around the country. And I was surprised because I learned that there was more than my state. And that is something that I feel like Brazilians don't... I mean, of course, I'm generalizing a lot here. But I think that's one of the main differences between American and Brazilian culture. We learn a lot about other countries, but we lack the will to kind of travel here and kind of learn about, especially us from the Southeast. We have that kind of ignorance when it comes to
other parts of Brazil, you mean?
Brazil, yeah exactly. Okay. And that was something kind of embarrassing at first. But it was good to learn. And I learned that there are more places other than São Paulo in Brazil that I'm willing to live in.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely understand. I don't think it's embarrassing either because I've always really lived on the East Coast, the northeastern part of the country. And, you know, going to California for the first time, it's like a whole new world. So,
yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I definitely understand. So let's get into our discussion on the part of history that you want to share from Brazil, which if you want to tell the audience what that is, and then just explain like how we want to unpack that in terms of what it means now for Brazilians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We... we'll talk about what we call the Golden Law. It's kind of like, we call it Lei Áurea in Portuguese for those who speak Portuguese. And then in English, you can translate it as like the Golden Law. And it was a law, it was the law that abolished slavery. And it was passed on May 13th, 1888. So it's really, it's very recent.
That's very recent, yeah.
And yeah, it is.
I appreciate that you looked up that date ahead of time because the fact that you had that ready to go was awesome.
Yeah, I took my notes.
I know you did. That was great.
Yeah, so, and I think it's interesting to talk about the process. I mean, I'm no historian or I don't study history, but since I lived in the US, I became more interested in the, in facts and learning a little bit more about race and class, as I told you, and especially because I had always lived in Brazil as a white person, and then I became a person of color when I was in the US.
Right.
And that was one of the eye-opening aspects of my experience abroad.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Probably a shock there.
Oh, yeah. I remember our professor was like, how do you feel about becoming a person of color now? And I couldn't answer because I was too shocked.
You didn't like, know that you were.
I didn't. Thank you for letting me know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I started reflecting a little bit more on how race and class they permeate and they kind of, they are the basis, the foundation for most, if not all, the society issues that we have today. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say society issues in Brazil or like around the world, do you think?
I would say around the world, definitely.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember learning at school when I was a child that the princess, her name is Isabel, the princess who had passed this law, she fought for the slaves and she was part of the abolitionist movement. And then we would have these, like our teachers would have us draw these beautiful, like, two hands, and then they were breaking these chains, and then we would have the like a picture of Princess Isabel in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not sure, I feel like things might have changed today because I teach at a school, and I can see a more reflexive history education. So I can see that students now, they reflect more on what they're learning. I remember as a child learning that way and kind of having this, not passion, but this respect for this very good princess that had freed our slaves. So she was the daughter of Brazil's emperor, Pedro II.
Okay.
And so she was obviously a member of our royal family back then, right?
Okay. The royal family, were they like Portuguese descent?
Yes, yes.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, yeah, we were discovered, right?
He's doing air quotes just for the listeners. Quote unquote discovered. Yeah.
Quote unquote. Yeah. Discovered by the Portuguese. So for those who don't know, that's the reason we speak Portuguese. And that's one of the reasons for a lot of other things that we go through in Brazil nowadays. She was a member of the royal family. And history, I mean, some people say that she took advantage that her dad wasn't in Brazil and she passed the law because she really wanted to do that favor to the slaves, and she wanted, like, she really fought for them. But so that's what I learned. And then the truth is that actually, there had been a lot of pressure by the international community and by several abolitionist movements to actually to end slavery in Brazil, because we weren't one of the last countries, if not the last one, to abolish slavery.
Okay.
I was checking, actually, the U.S., I think the U.S. abolished slavery in 1860-something, and then Brazil was 1880 88. Yeah. And then even nowadays, a couple of years ago, I think there was this, there was a lot of protests, and people were kind of shocked because the mayor of the city where the royal family used to live in, he threw this this party to celebrate Princess Isabel, and it was this he suffered this huge backlash. But it's actually something that people still think about and still believe nowadays, that she was this benevolent icon that fought for the slaves.
Okay. Yeah. So does most of the credit for ending slavery go to her, or are there actual former slaves or people who died as slaves who are given credit for that movement?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Because the French Revolution, I think they had this ideals of liberty, and then the abolitionist movement kind of gained strength around the world, and then there was this creation of consumer markets, and then workers started to have different working relationship, and then it was like the start of this of people valuing free labor, not free as not paid, but free as like you get paid to work and you're not kept as a slave.
Okay.
And then the English wanted to expand their market to Brazil, but they needed consumers. Which means they needed more workers, free workers with money and not slaves. And then they prohibited the traffic of enslaved people in 1807.
Oh, okay. So you couldn't buy and sell slaves in 1807.
Yeah.
So it was like, if you had slaves, then you got to keep them, but you just couldn't. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that lasted for like 80 years like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. And then there was this law that would allow the English Navy to arrest and punish any trafficking vessels around the ocean in around Brazil.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's when the abolitionist movement kind of started to gain strength here. And then a lot of Black people fought for the Paraguay War. They fought in the Paraguay War, lasting from 1864 to 1870. And then they gained even more strength. And then people in general started, I mean, not that easily, of course, but just to sum it up, that's when the abolitionist movement started to actually be a thing here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And then as the market was under such such a strong pressure, the price of slaves took off. It was it would be really expensive to get an enslaved person. And then the farmers, they could, they'd rather pay people to work for them than to keep paying the high prices of a slave person.
Okay.
And then a lot of the Black resistance kind of started these rebellions. New laws started to be passed. And then there was this we call it the Ventre Livre law. Let me just it's kind of like a rough translation would be like the free womb law. And it was in 1871, and it would make, so if you were an enslaved woman, and if you were born starting from 1871, then you would be born free.
Oh, and then, interesting.
Yeah, and then there was this another law in 1885, and then it would free the slaves older than 60.
Wow, so Brazil was really moving towards the direction of ending slavery and like all these small steps, it sounds like. Like it sounds like throughout that 80-year period, there were like smaller laws passed or smaller movements that were like leading up to it without actually officially ending slavery.
Yeah, but that was a huge problem because they were just freed, but there was no support or anything to them. And that is something that still reflects to nowadays.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the Princess Isabel, she actually just signed the law because of all the pressure. So it wasn't really like something that she actually fought for.
It wasn't like a heroic, benevolent kind of thing. It was an international and a national pressure, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And then that kind of pushed the proclamation of our republic. And then the end of also people feared that the end of slavery would cause the economy to collapse.
And I think that was huge in the movement in the United States as well, right? That was that was absolutely one of the rationales for not wanting to end slavery was the economic impact.
The Golden Law was a kind of a victory for enslaved people, but they were never compensated. That was the beginning. I mean, not the beginning, but that just kind of solidified inequality. It perpetuated inequality in Brazil. And then you have, even nowadays, you have the famous favelas, which are mostly comprised of Black people. Mm-hmm. And just how inequality kind of harms Black people the most.
Yeah, and so just to talk about that a little bit more, you said that when slavery was ended, basically there was nothing done for the people who had been enslaved. Like they weren't given land compensation, anything. So I understand how that negatively impacts the ability for that community to advance economically. Can you talk about how Black people, former slaves then, were regarded and treated by the rest of society then? So in addition to probably obvious poverty coming out of slavery, were those people also facing discrimination based on the fact that they were former slaves, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's something, I think it's interesting to talk about that if you think about how things are today. Usually, so we have a very, like our society is still very much shaped by the slavery times. And it's pretty common for middle class and higher middle class families to have maids. Mm-hmm. And most of in the past they used to live in, I remember my grandmother, so she worked as a maid and she lived in the farm where she would work.
Right.
I lived with her. And so that was one, that's one of the things that are still discussed today about how we have these like daily maids that just clean after you. And then there's also the question of our, we have university quotas for Black and Indigenous people and also underprivileged people. And it's pretty recent. Mm-hmm. I think it's not even like 10 years old, or maybe I'm just wrong, but it's recent. And it's interesting to talk about that as well, because as I was both doing my master's and teaching at the university where I taught, so these two, I did my master's in one university and I taught in another one. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see that when these quotas, these, how do you call those in English?
Quota is the right word. You mean like there's a certain number of students that need to be Indigenous or of a certain race or group, right? Quota can work. That's mm-hmm. right.
But there's a different word.
I think there's a different, yeah, I think there's a different word, but I know what you mean. And there's a whole discussion around that in the United States.
Yeah, but there's, well. I'm trying to, a reparation.
Is that what they're calling it? We don't call it that. No, that has a different connotation, I think, in the United States.
Okay.
The word reparation.
Yeah, but let's just call it quotas.
Okay.
And then it was interesting to see a shift in the demographics inside these two universities. So the first year, on my last year of my master's degree, they started taking these students through these quota systems. And it was shocking to see that it would resemble more what the country looks like than it was before. So I'm talking about how the students started to become more like darker skinned than it was before.
And when did they implement those quota requirements? That sounds, from what you're saying, it sounds like that was a recent thing. Is that recent?
It is. Let me just take, it is. Let me just take a look. 2003.
Okay.
That was the first school, the first university in Rio started in 2003. The university where I studied, 40% of the spots were destined to students who would declare themselves as from the public school, mm-hmm. Or they were either of color or like Black, Pardos, or Indigenous.
Okay.
And that was in 2019.
Okay.
Before it was a smaller number.
Yeah, 2019 is recent. I mean, for that type of a movement. And so just
even 2003, if you think about it.
Yeah, 2003. I mean, that's all very recent within the last 20 years. Because obviously Brazil's demographics have always been this way. That's not a recent change.
And yeah, it's not like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know you and I, you've told me a lot about demographics in Brazil. Can you share what the true demographics of Brazil are like for people so that when you talk about like quotas and having a university actually represent the population of Brazil, and especially when you're talking about the history of slavery, can you give the listeners an idea of like, well, what is the percentage of that breakdown in Brazil, or just a rough idea?
Yeah, I'm actually checking that the data right now.
Because I know something you and I have talked about a lot is the misrepresentation of Brazil on an international scale. And
oh, definitely.
Can you explain that a little bit? Like what you've seen versus what is reality in Brazil?
Oh, yeah. Well, even like in my, so I work and study, I have worked and studied in pretty much very white, middle class, higher middle class environments. So I also feel like I do not have the kind of, I haven't lived around as many not white, non-white people. And that was something, for example, when I traveled to places where the percentage of Black people is higher, that was something that was kind of, it was very clear to me that I wasn't used to just navigating in general around non-white communities. And when I say white, I'm talking about Brazilian white, because of course, for an American person, no one is white here. But so we're all Latino, which is also a term that we never use. Right. And we kind of just learn it when we go to America. So, yeah.
Surprise, this is what you are. Yeah.
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 So our statistics body called the IBGE. So according to a national survey, according to a sample from 2012 to 2019, 42% of Brazilian people are white, declared themselves as white.
Okay.
9.4% declare themselves as Black.
Okay.
46.8% declared themselves as, so we have this word pardo, which is a source for a lot of controversy, but it's pardo is usually someone who isn't Black nor white.
Okay.
So I could consider myself as pardo, for example, and then 46.8% of the Brazilian population consider themselves as that. And then 1.1% is indigenous.
Okay. Okay. Can we talk about like what that 46% means? Because I think the appropriate word in English would be like mixed race. Does that sound correct or no?
It does not. No.
Okay. So can you explain more what that means?
Sure. I think discussing race in Brazil versus in the US is totally different.
Okay.
So first of all, I feel like what I felt when I was in the US is that every ethnic community is pretty much aware of their race and they kind of stick together and they fight for rights, and they usually, you know what I mean? They are very aware of what their race is.
Okay.
And in Brazil, we're starting now to get more aware of being Black and not being white. But I think that's of course, there has been a lot of people fighting for that for a long time. But the mainstream media just recently started taking these issues publicly. And because we have this kind of idea that we live in a racial democracy, and I'm sure that you might have heard about that term before,
mm-hmm.
And that's not true. So this word pardo that I was talking about is a category used by the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics. Is kind of complex, but it's used to refer to Brazilians of mixed ethnic ancestries. But okay. We don't, so for example, in the US, people are usually like, oh yeah, I'm biracial, I have a Black mom and a white dad, or my mom is Asian and my dad is Chinese, my mom is, I don't know, Japanese and my dad is it's French. So yeah. That's something also very different from Brazil. We usually we don't have this kind of awareness of where we come from, especially because a lot of our ancestry was kind of erased because the enslaved people would come here and they would get their owners' names.
Right.
Yeah. I'm reading the definition here, and the word Pardo is usually a mixture of Europeans, sub-Saharan Africans, and or native Brazilians, which is usually regarded as the indigenous population.
Okay. And why is that term right now, what is controversial about that term in Brazil?
Because there's a discussion about what is skin color and what is race.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first time that this word was used in a Brazilian census was in 1872. And then it's kind of like it has its source in since the beginning of colonization of Brazil. And I think it has this, I think it gives this idea of, yeah, that's what I said, like not being white and not being black. Okay. But you usually don't, that's kind of more like a scientific word. I don't think you would describe, oh yeah, that Pardo girl, like you wouldn't describe someone using that word.
Okay. Okay, but you said that if they were doing the census or whatever, if they were asking you, that you might identify yourself that way?
I might, but I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Like that, and that's how most of Brazilians kind of see themselves. It's kind of like a fuzzy reality when it comes to discussing your own race here.
Yeah.
Except for people who identify themselves as black. Which yeah. I don't have any black family member, although my grandmother says that her grandmother was a freed slave, but and that's what is interesting here in the U.S. You usually say like, oh, I have, I don't know, a quarter of black blood or a quarter of black ancestry, and that doesn't really happen here.
Okay. Okay. So it's not such a strong identification with where your family originates from in Brazil.
Definitely not. Well, not for usually lower middle class people, which is how I was born.
Okay.
Usually when you have like more European looking people in Brazil, they usually are like, they're usually like, yeah, I am Italian or I am German, especially people from the south of the country. But not if you're not like super white and wealthy and usually descending from some European country, you don't really have much of an idea of where you come from.
Right. Okay. And also, just to give the listeners more context, Brazil, you can give more detail and correct me. Brazil is sort of similar to the United States in terms of it being an immigrant population. Now, immigration due to slavery also being included there, but mm-hmm. I think you in Brazil, you have like an even more diverse immigrant population than the United States. I know globally, the U.S. and Brazil are like both way up there compared to other countries in terms of like you have people from everywhere in Brazil. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have like the specifics.
Yeah, that's a hard question, but
yeah, but we do have. So during when we were a colony, we would obviously have a lot of Portuguese people and African people, although we don't study specific countries of Africa, or we usually don't know our ancestry based on specific African countries, which is kind of a shame because it's kind of horrible just to say like, yeah, Africans, right? What does that even mean? It's just like saying Americans, and that would include Brazil and Mexico and the U.S. and Canada.
Right.
There was a lot of German immigration, German and Italian immigration, especially in the south of the country. So Brazil is divided in the north, the southeast, northeast, southeast, Midwest, and south.
Okay.
So yeah, our division is more of like a vertical division, whereas in the US you have a more horizontal division, right? The regions.
Right.
And then we have a very large, we have the biggest Japanese community outside of Japan, I think, in São Paulo.
Yeah, which I never knew that until I met you and other people from Brazil. That was really new to me.
Yeah, we are recently having a lot of Syrian and people from Syria and Lebanon, especially in the city of São Paulo, in the capital. Mm-hmm. And then we had this whitening policies and
Whitening policy?
Yeah, in late by late 19th century, we had this, there was this rise of a concept of racial superiority, and then the government tried to whiten the population by giving more benefits to European people who would like to come and work here. These policies happened from 1888, which was when we had our slaves freed, to 1920.
So the policies were basically like helping people from Europe to move to Brazil. And was it removing the incentive for people from other parts of the world, like from African and Asian countries, like to move there? Is that the idea?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think it was making it easier for people. I know that Italians, we have a huge population of Italian descendants here.
Right. You're talking about people who are whiter in Brazil wanting to identify with where yeah. they're from, or we could also say like having the luxury to like think about like where they're yeah. from and the time and the resources to figure out where they're from, right?
Yeah, I think definitely.
I think that's interesting because I know with me and a lot of Americans, like it's just something that we want to feel like we have a connection to, which I don't think is a bad thing, but I think it comes as a luxury too. Like, it's nice that like I've been able to know my family and my parents know their family's histories, and that can go back and back, and like it's something that we've been able to sort of pass on, and that's not the reality for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have no idea where I come from.
Yeah. You're
yeah, so Brazil. I was yeah, I'm from Brazil. That's all yeah. I know.
Yeah.
So I did some quick research here, and then this Dr. Lacerda, he was one of the main exponents of the whitening thesis among Brazilians. There was this Universal Congress of Races in London in 1911. And it brought together intellectuals from all over the world to debate racism and the relationship of races regarding the progress of civilizations. And then this doctor he defended in this event, he defended the miscegenation factor as something positive in Brazil, due to the overlapping of the right race over the others, black and indigenous. Mm. So he says that the mixed population of Brazil must in the span of a century look very different from the current one. The currents of European immigration increasing every day, the white element of the population will, after a certain time, end up suffocating the element in which some traces of the black could persist.
Wow. And was he like a lawmaker in Brazil? Did he implement those laws?
No, he was a doctor and an anthropologist.
Okay. But people in power did.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are these topics, the harder controversial topics taught in school? I know you said like when you were learning about the abolishment of slavery, you learned like the happy, like Isabel, the Portuguese descendant princess, like saved everyone from slavery, which as you know now, obviously you said that's not really the reality. So are students in schools learning what we're talking about now regarding race and the history of race in Brazil?
I think there has been a change. I have a friend who has worked at this this project for the education department, and she would teach these controversial topics. She would teach high school children these controversial topics, and then she would teach them about race and class. But I'm not sure how widespread that is, because our education is state run, not right. It's not run by the federal government. Well, yeah, each state has a certain freedom to work their education system.
Right.
But regarding the whitening policies, there were actually two eras. And the second one, the most government-backed one, was during our dictatorship.
Okay.
Which makes total sense.
Right. And what period of time was that, just for those of us that don't know?
That was 1964 to 1985.
Okay. And they were promoting those policies of getting European people to settle in Brazil.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. They were actually, they had this idea that the more white people that they would bring, the less black people would remain in the country. The less the black race would remain in the country.
Interesting. And that, of course, that really never came to fruition in terms of getting those immigrants and, of course, in terms of shifting the demographics, correct?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't sound very dissimilar from the United States, you know. We might not have had the exact same policies, but, you know, I'm not an expert. I'm not the person to talk about it, but we have an awful history of trying to do the same thing. So
yeah, redlining and Jim Crow and
yeah, and I still don't know so much even about that history in the United States, because in our education system we learned the really nice, easy version of that as well, right? Like whoever the princess is about, I guess you'd say Abraham Lincoln, right? Like Abraham Lincoln was credited with a lot of that. And that is shifting in the United States now too, I think, the way people learn about it. But obviously so much is hidden. You have to really like dig to find the details of a lot of that.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting how I feel like this shift kind of happened at the same time that I went to the United States, in Brazil at least, that shift towards like talking about race and feminism and class. That started to be really like a mainstream thing since like, I would say 2013, 14. So it's something very, very recent here.
And would you owe some of that to like globalization and social media? Because I know in the United States, I would say that was a big factor. Or were there other things in Brazil that you felt like?
I think also the 13 years of we had this this government who focused on how do you call that social well-being, social
like social
welfare,
yeah, social programs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and then we had a huge. So we got out of the UN hunger map. And then people started to leave extreme poverty.
Yeah.
And then access to the internet and education. So I think it was a set of things that were put together and that kind of ignited this. It was like this spark that ignited the flame, and then everything just kind of started. And I feel like there has been a very loud conversation now. I feel like most people, like even in my town, for example, people know that it's not okay to make like racist or homophobic jokes. You know what I mean? I think, of course, it's very, very, very slow, but there has been some change. But of course, I'm talking about my region, okay? So
right.
I like to reinforce that again, because Brazil is gigantic and I can only speak about my own experience.
Right.
Especially because I live in one of the most developed states of the country.
Right.
So don't take my word for like the entire country. I'm just talking about where I live. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And so one of the last things I wanted to ask you about regarding the history of the end of slavery and how that's progressed over time to current times, what is something that you want people in other countries to know about this, aside from just knowing that history exists and that things are the way they are now in Brazil? Why did you feel that that was an important story to share today?
I think I like for people to know that if they've ever heard that Brazil is this racial democracy, that
Do you mean like a racial utopia where like everyone's like...
No, there is a term that they call it a racial democracy.
Okay.
Yeah,
racial democracy. What does that mean?
It means that... it means it's a term used to describe race relations in Brazil, that we all live peacefully, that racism is not a thing.
Okay.
And a lot of Brazilians actually believe that.
Okay.
I mean, of course, if they're white.
Yeah.
So they do believe that calling someone something just because they're black, or assuming that a black person is dangerous, they don't think that's racist. You know what I mean? And they're like, if you accuse someone of being racist, they would be like, no, but there is no such thing in Brazil. Like, we are not racist. Racism is not a thing anymore. I have black friends. I have black employees.
Right.
So I just feel like that's something worth knowing about Brazil, and maybe even reflecting about your own country. Like, are you sure you have a real idea of what things are like when it comes to other races if you're white?
Right. Definitely. And I think not even if you're white in a country like Brazil or the United States, but like maybe you belong to a country that is a very homogenous population, and maybe the large percent of people are the same race.
Yeah.
So maybe that's just not on people's radar too. So I think that's important too, because sometimes in those countries, you've got racism that occurs in a different kind of way, which I
definitely
obviously can't speak to, but race is important everywhere, unfortunately, right? Like, it it does influence like every society, I think. But in some countries, it's in a totally different way than others. So I think that's a really good point. Like, I like that idea of just trying to get people to like consider whether or not that is.
I mean, I talk about myself as white, but at the same time, well, that's the thing. I'm not white in, I'm not black in Brazil, but at the same time, I'm not like European white in Brazil, if you know what I mean.
Right. Definitely.
Like, I'm in that middle ground, and I studied, I went to college through this quota system. So I am part of the, I didn't take the quota benefit from through the class system, but through the race system, but through, like, I studied in a public school, so I had this scholarship, and my entire college was paid for by the federal government.
Right.
So I'm just saying this, like, I don't want to be, I don't want to sound like, oh, but what is this white guy talking about? Slavery in Brazil, but actually I'm not, like, it's what I'm saying. I'm not black, but I'm not white as well.
Right. And just hearing you explain that, I think is hopefully eye-opening to people to understand what race is like in Brazil, right? Explaining how you feel like you fit in to the society is, I think that's helpful to like really understand that picture. I didn't understand that until I talked a lot with you about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even I started to, like, I'm still figuring this out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. It sounds like it's not something that is clear in Brazil. It doesn't sound like there's a clear...
Definitely. And I also think that it's recent that it's recent that I started to understand that it was not a problem to not be fair skinned. So for example, when I was a child, I remember if someone made any comments about, oh, I love how you look tan, or something that would make me feel like my skin wasn't white, that would make me super ashamed. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's still something that happens. Wow. We are walking towards a better place, but still like not even that close to, not even like start seeing things getting better. We're just giving baby steps.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I love hearing your perspective on this. I know, like, we've been talking about this for like 5 or 6 years since I met you, and like it's always really good to get your perspective, and you're very open about sharing and like listening, and I think that you alone, like in your personal interactions, you must be opening a lot of people's minds to this concept. So
I hope so. Yeah,
definitely you are. Definitely you are. And I love that you joined me for my first podcast because,
oh, thank you. That was amazing.
Yeah. I think that you have like a real talent for sharing, with people, and yeah, it's been really helpful. So is there anything else you want to like share with our listeners, or anything else you want to like talk about on the subject?
No, I would just like to, maybe you can share my email or something. So if people want to make any comments, or if I said something that I wasn't supposed to say, I'm just open to hearing and
to getting feedback. Yeah,
definitely. It's something I'm looking forward to. So
definitely.
I would like to thank you for inviting me, and also thanking anyone who might be listening to this, and saying that it was amazing, and also saying I'm sorry if something wasn't totally right. But I like to talk about things through my own experience. So
yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for being on, and I'll talk to you and we can share your email info. I just want to make sure I have everything right so I can post that whenever we share this as well. But also that was a great point. I think with all of our podcast episodes, we're going to ask that if you have feedback to reach out to us and let us know even if it's not feedback, but just a different perspective as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think that's critical because no individual can represent everybody in their society. And so it's always great to hear from other people as well. But
yeah, and I'm no history expert. So you know what I mean? I'm just talking through the perspective of a citizen.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And hopefully we'll be back with another episode soon. But this has been a really great first one. So thank you.
Thank you. That was amazing.